You are listening to Rouge, White, and Blue, a proud member of the Canadian Football Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Rouge, White, and Blue podcast. My name is Joe Pritchard. With me, as always, is Dr. Rouge out of Pittsburgh. And Oz Davis this week is on assignment, but we do have a special guest in Andrew Buchholz. Andrew, thanks for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
We got a lot to talk about, so let's just get started. I don't really think we need to beat around the bush all that much. It seems like there's a bit of dissension in the ranks between the CFL players, not really enjoying the fact that ownership seems to be wanting to tie them into their two-year contracts at entry level these days. Definitely going to see some issues with the CBAs coming up next year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is something that's been going on for a while. This is not something that's new. And what this really does come of is that decision a few years ago to take out the idea of the NFL option window. And the problem that's really come up as a result of this is because some general managers have essentially made those sort of handshake agreements where, hey, we will release you if it looks like you've got an NFL chance, and others have not and don't want to do that. And so there's a whole divide on if players can expect that, if that should be the norm, and what players are going to do if they don't want to play in the CFL for a low rookie deal, but can't force their way out to the NFL. So I think it's a tension that's been boiling for a long time. It's a tension we've seen with a lot of players before, with even things like the Chris Williams situation, even though that was slightly different with it being a two-year versus a three-year deal. But the central tension, really, of the CFL is that it wants to bring these new guys in at low salaries. It wants to keep them under team control at those low salaries, or if they do renegotiate, it wants to tie them up for a longer period. And for a lot of those guys, the CFL isn't the end goal. It's getting to the NFL and making the bigger money there. And it's understandable that there's tensions over that because the sides are so far apart and there's no real way to resolve it.
Andrew, then as you look at the horizon a year, 2 years down the line, is this the issue for which the dreaded word strike might become reality?
Well, I mean, it's possible, but I think if this did lead to a strike or a lockout or any sort of labor dispute ahead of the next CBA negotiations, I think it would be one factor amongst many. I don't think it's going to be the sole factor. And a big part of that comes down to the makeup of the CFL Players Association, which is comprised of a lot of people in very different situations who want very different things. Historically, a lot of the people who have been most active in the union have been the people who are in the CFL for the long term, whether that's Canadian veterans or American veterans. And that's why, in some respects, they've maybe given in on issues like the end of the NFL option window, because it's not really about the guys who are in the CFL for the long term. And like with any sort of negotiation, it's going to come down to what trade-offs they're willing to make elsewhere. For example, if the owners offered to raise the minimum salary across the board significantly, but not bring back the NFL option window, I think that's something that would probably sit better with the majority of players. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a real question of I'm sure the players would love to get that back. They'd love to have the option to sign shorter term deals as rookies to go to the NFL. But it's a question of how much they want that versus all the other things that they would like in the next negotiation.
Mm.
Right, and your point being that the veterans are the ones in control, and we've seen down in the States, at least with the MLB and the NFL, that what the veterans want tends to be what goes, because the rookies and the players that haven't gotten to the league yet don't really have a seat at the table.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine seeing them hold out for that issue specifically. Maybe you'll see them trying to grab that option window if possible. But with the fact that one-year contracts are in vogue now for veterans, I can't see that as even as something that they would hold out for much at all for.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think you hit on the key thing there of this isn't just a CFL thing. It's something that we've seen across all leagues where essentially players have agreed to harsher restrictions and lower salaries for rookies, for younger players who don't have that vote yet. And then the thought is, well, they'll make it back by the time they hit unrestricted free agency. The problem with that from a holistic standpoint is there's a whole lot of guys who come into these leagues who do not stick around long enough for unrestricted free agency and who might be better off overall if they were able to use a league like the CFL for 1 or 2 years as a way to get to the NFL. But those guys also aren't the majority, and that's not really who I don't think they're really the ones being strongly considered in terms of what's best for them here.
And I know. And the other thing too, is that this becomes a double-edged sword. And I'm sorry, Dr. Urge, I'll let you get the next word in, but, it becomes a double-edged sword because the veterans are holding out for the higher salaries for when they get their payday. But then the owners, seeing that the rookie players get less on the whole, are starting to make choices where they're not taking that veteran at the higher salary. They'll take a little bit of a reduction in talent and spend a whole lot less on a rookie.
Exactly, and that's something we've seen in the CFL for decades, and we were seeing it in big ways this offseason with guys like Charleston Hughes and Odell Willis on the move, not necessarily strictly because of a decline in production. I think in Hughes' case in particular, he showed he still was playing at very high level last year, but it's about that idea of trying to get cheaper and save room under the salary cap to spend at other positions. And if you have younger rookies who are going to be making less money and you think they can provide similar production or production without that much of a drop off, that's what you do. So yes, it does wind up hurting some of the veteran players in the end. It works out okay for them as long as someone in the league is willing to pay them a decent salary. But the challenge comes if no one is.
You mentioned Hughes, and when Joe and I were chatting, you know, as we were prepping the podcast for this week, one of the things we discussed was inevitably bringing the conversation around to Hughes and Willis and Bowman, who I think are the three sort of big names that attracted attention in the last, you know, 6 or 7 days. Of those three, did any of those three moves surprise you more than the other? Why? And then the last question that I'll have in this round, so to speak, is where do you think Bowman ends up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Hughes move surprised me the most, just given the level that he was playing at, and given that, I mean, Calgary has made some of these moves over the years, like a bunch of other teams, but Hughes seemed to be a guy who they wanted for long term. So it's a bit of a surprising move there to me. The Willis and Bowman also a little surprising. I think Bowman more than Willis. Odell Willis is a very talented, very productive player, but he's also a player who's had a lot of different stops over the years. And it, again, at defensive line in particular, that's a position where I think a lot of GMs think they can make an impact with rookies or with younger players, with maybe less overall learning there than you have at the slot back position. So, I mean, I think they're all surprising moves to in some respect. I do think that a guy like Bowman is going to be, I think all of those guys are going to be able to contribute in this league this coming year if they want to, and if they're willing, if they're able to get a deal that works for them in terms of what they're being paid. I don't know specifically where Bowman's going to land at this point, but there's a lot of people who could use him, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I know Joe would secretly or maybe openly wish that he ends up in Winnipeg, right, Joe?
I could definitely see the Bombers trying at least for a guy that can blow the top off of a defense. It just feels like that's something that they lack. They seem to have a lot more possession receivers, and may very well fit better with Matt Nichols' skill set, especially with Andrew Harris around for the dump offs, mm-hmm. Which seems like that you see that play quite often. But yeah, I would love to see a guy that takes the top off of a defense, but I don't know if they don't have the money to sign some of the defensive back talent. I don't know where they're going to find the mm-hmm. money for Bowman.
And I mean, they did sign or re-sign Mo Leggett this week.
Woohoo!
And it's funny. I saw the celebration coming from north of Madison, Wisconsin, and I knew exactly who that was when those fireworks were going off. All right. Taking sort of the frivolity out of it for a second, you know, there have been again in the last couple of days, Mo Leggett signing in Winnipeg or re-signing in Winnipeg, and Deontay Spencer re-upping in Ottawa. Andrew, if you were to sort of scan the horizon before we get to free agency next week, who are the one or two players that you anticipate will re-up with their current teams and ultimately not end up on the market?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. The thing that strikes me about CFL free agency is there always seem to be more players re-upping than I would expect versus mm-hmm. actually hitting the open market. And I think maybe that says something about where the salaries are in this league and about the value of comfort in just staying in a place where you're familiar. I'm not sure who I could really pick out as guys extremely likely to do that, but I think we are going to see a fair bit. I think there's going to be a significant wave of that before we actually hit the opening period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, speaking of waves, what was it, Friday, where all the trades came out? What do you think was the trigger for just a chaotic day of action? Was it just one of these pieces moving around finally that got everybody else to make their decisions on things, or where did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of fascinating, and especially with two guys, with both Willis and Hughes being traded twice in the same day. I mean, that's really unusual, even for the CFL. I think part of what happened there is teams both realizing after those first trades those guys were actually on the market and then making further offers for them. And then I think another part of it is I think those first trades happened just because those teams in Calgary and Edmonton didn't want to deal talent within the division. But as that whole day showed, that seems like a pretty fruitless stance at this point in time, because then, A, you're limiting your market for those guys, so you may not get top value, and nothing stops a team you deal them from turning around and dealing them to someone else. So I think if anything, it showed that, A, the teams that acquired those guys in the first place were like they liked the idea of bringing them in, but they were also willing to flip them if they saw something better. And B, that in a 9-team league, I don't think you can really be too picky about who you deal with, because they may wind up there anyway.
How much did the balance of power in the West switch or flip, if at all, with Hughes now in Saskatchewan, with Willis in BC, and Bowman, again, we don't know where he's going to end up, mm-hmm. but certainly he's not going to be wearing an Edmonton uniform next season. Again, I know it's only three players, and I know we haven't gotten the draft yet. I know we've not gotten to free agency yet, but if you were to assess the West at this point, post-trade frenzy, where do we stand?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think that in a lot of ways, I think the Calgary Stampeders are still the team to beat there, even though they came out, I don't think they came out all that well out of these trades. I mean, this was a move really in Lango Hughes that I think is going to make them a little worse on the field, but does maybe free up a little money for them and gives them a bit of an edge there. But I think Calgary was so good last year. They still have a lot of really good pieces, and I don't think anyone moved past them with this. I think the team that maybe improved the most out of this is maybe the Saskatchewan Roughriders. I think they've made some really nice moves in this offseason. Mm-hmm. But then I think the real challenge for them is going to be getting under the cap. And I think that we're going to see a couple of big-name players cut in their training camp just because I don't think that they can manage to fit all these well-known guys under that cap. So I'm really interested to see what their roster is going to look like as we actually get into the season versus what it looks like right now.
Right. One of the bigger pieces of news that came out of this week that wasn't trade related was Jerron Carter, mm-hmm. and his unfortunate brushes with the law. Is he potentially one of those guys that we're not going to see in a Rider uniform this year?
I mean, I'd be surprised if that happened, especially with Chris Jones running things there. I don't think Chris Jones really cares about if a player is arrested for marijuana possession. Like, that doesn't really strike me as the biggest deal in the world. And I think that's something to keep in mind with this, too. Yeah, it's problematic. Yeah, it wasn't a good move on Carter's front, and he should have known better. But this is something that's going to be federally legalized in Canada this summer. And so I think, sure, there have been some hot takes over this and Jerron Carter letting the Rough Riders down and whatever. But at the end of the day, he's still an incredibly talented receiver, one of the best in the CFL. He was tremendous for the Rough Riders last season. I don't think they're going to let him go over this. I think they'd be very dumb to do so, but you never know.
Yeah, and my understanding is his contract isn't as high as it potentially could be, so that might be another factor in the Riders keeping him. It may have been a convenient excuse had he been to the point where they needed to shed a lot of salary real quick, but mm-hmm. I think I'm with you on that. I don't see that, but it's definitely a question worth asking, given it sounds like there's been at least a couple of these brushes already, but like you said, it doesn't seem to be that big of a deal.
Well, I think the thing that's interesting is keep in mind how this compares to a similar situation a couple of years ago. In 2013, with Jonathan Hefney in Winnipeg during the offseason, where he wound up being busted for marijuana possession that was in the U.S. The team sort of gave him some delayed discipline at first. There wasn't a lot of, like, outright speaking about it, but there were a whole lot of people very mad about it in the media and a few fans very mad about it, and then he eventually wound up getting cut during training camp. I don't think that's going to happen with Carter, and I think part of that is because the attitudes on marijuana have changed in Canada, and to a degree where it is going to be federally legalized this year. So I think that's maybe dialed down some of the fury you would otherwise see a little bit, and made this, while this is still a problem, while this is still a thing that makes Jerron Carter look bad and makes the Rough Riders look a little bad by extension, I don't think it's the biggest deal in the world, and I think it's something they can move past.
Agreed. You posted a piece, I think it was this morning, it may have been late yesterday, but I ended up reading it today, regarding what ESPN Plus is going to be. Mm-hmm. And I think if you've read some of the other pieces that were posted about it today in the States, a lot of negativity, and maybe negativity is too strong a word, certainly a lot of debate about how credible it's going to be. Setting aside that for a second, talk to the CFL fans like Joe, like me, who are here in this, who live in the States and mm-hmm. have relied on ESPN for the ability to watch the game, typically through our cable system. Mm-hmm. Are we, you know, where does ESPN Plus put us in the opportunity to watch the three or four CFL games that will take place during the regular season in 2018 and beyond?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question, and it's one that people don't really know the answer to at this point, because they haven't revealed exactly what's going to be on ESPN Plus versus what's going to be continuing on ESPN ESPN streaming platforms, but with your cable subscription. So, I think there's certainly a possibility that the CFL content winds up being behind that ESPN Plus paywall. And that can be good and it can be bad. It's good in terms for the people who don't currently have a cable package and who don't currently have ESPN, who don't want to subscribe to full cable. And if the CFL is one of the main sports they want to watch and that winds up on ESPN Plus, well, that's an over-the-top offering. So they can get that for just the $5 a month. It's bad for those of us who already pay for a regular cable package and would have to look at adding that $5 a month on. And I think the CFL is not the big thing here. It's not the thing that they're building ESPN Plus around. It's not the thing that most people are going to subscribe to ESPN Plus for. But it is a significant thing for those of us who are CFL fans in the United States. And there isn't really a lot of indication at the moment which way they're going to go with that. If I had to make a bet, though, I think there's a pretty good chance it does wind up on ESPN Plus, and we do all wind up having to pay an extra $5 a month.
If for no other reason, it's a professional sports league, and, right. and you could sell it, for lack of a better phrase, to the audience that way. Interesting. Joe, I cut you off. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just going to make mention that right now I have the best of both worlds as far as not having traditional cable because I'm able to, through Sling TV, get ESPN2 and ESPN3 literally on my Roku, like right next to each other, for a lot less than it cost me for a normal cable package. But if they pull ESPN, if the plan is to pull ESPN off of that, I might be in deep trouble because I would not have – if ESPN Plus does not also have ESPN2 access, that's a lot of games in July – or June, July, and August that I wouldn't have access to at that point.
Yeah, well, I mean, you should be fine there because ESPN loves those digital MVPDs like Sling TV. That's been a big thing of what they've been talking about what's working for them and what's helping to slow their subscriber losses. So I don't think they're going away from that anytime soon. And subscribing to anything like that is still going to give you the authentication and the login to things that are on ESPN regularly. So, I mean, you should still at the least be able to see whatever things they decide to throw up on ESPN2 and so on. The big question is really, though, if they decide that all this CFL content that they had been streaming, if that's going to remain free for the authenticated people or if they're going to add it to the ESPN Plus. And I mean, there's sort of an argument in both ways. I mean, a lot of their talk about ESPN Plus has been, this is going to be new things. It's going to be extra things. It's going to be things that will get people to sign up and pay more. And there definitely is going to be a lot of new content there. So maybe they'll focus on that. They'll go for good PR and make it entirely new things, and they'll keep streaming things like the CFL in the authenticated package. But I think it's also very possible that they decide, hey, this is something we've been just streaming all these years. Why not throw it into this extra streaming bundle and make a little more money from it? And with the CFL in particular, it's not in the U.S. it's not something that has a wide audience, but has a passionate audience. And so I think that's a group of people who are very likely to pay the extra $5 a month if they decide to go that way.
And yeah, if they do that, I'll be all shut up and take my money.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's fun that we talk about television and how you're watching the games and you know, and all of that. There obviously was a lot of discussion in November at the Grey Cup in Ottawa about what might be next for the domestic television rights for the CFL in Canada. Has there been any movement, any discussion that maybe has not trickled into the media in the off season about where the CFL brass might be thinking about going? And does the I'm forgetting the acronym right now, that the group that bought into the Argos, MLSE, thank you. With that and the connection there with Bell, does that perhaps change the discussion about where CFL games being on television in Canada might change in a year or two?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's going to be a change for a while. Bell currently has the rights locked up through 2021. I don't think there's any real indication that they want to get out of that or that the CFL wants to move away from that. Where it goes after that is a little more of an interesting question, perhaps. And a lot of the question there is going to be about what the landscape looks like in Canada at that point. If cord cutting is really spread, if there are lots of people without a cable subscription. I think you're going to see Bell make a strong push for these rights again. You're going to see them want to extend it, and especially because they don't have the NHL at the moment. And an interesting element of this, too, comes into it with the whole NFL rights that Bell has got, and particularly the Super Bowl. And I wrote a lot about how they've lost these court cases around the CRTC SimSup ruling, where they can't force Canadians to watch Canadian ads for the Super Bowl anymore. Mm-hmm. So they've lost a lot of money from that for the past 2 years. That's taken down the value of the NFL rights a bit. And so I think the CFL maybe gains a little bit in comparison from that, because now the Grey Cup and the Super Bowl are being watched by similar sized audiences, at least on the Canadian feed. So I think there's going to be strong interest in the CFL. I think Bell, when this comes up, I think Bell is the most likely to keep it, and they're most likely to keep it on TSN because that's a big driver for TSN's per subscriber fee at the moment. But you could maybe see them lobbying for some games for broadcast on CTV, or maybe even through some sort of deal of sub-licensing to the CBC, like Rogers does with Hockey Night in Canada. And you could maybe see tech companies become involved the way they are in the U.S. and try to do things over the top. By that point, even TSN might have their own over the top thing. So mm-hmm. that could be a factor as well. But for the moment, I think everyone's pretty happy with the status quo for 2021. TSN would obviously like better ratings, but I think the ratings are fine for them. I think there's going to be a bid made to retain the status quo, and a lot's just going to depend on where the landscape is and if anyone else really comes in at it. But I don't think the CFL is as good for Rogers because of their focus on the NHL. The CBC certainly doesn't have the bidding power to make a big run at it themselves because they're not getting those per subscriber fees. So mm-hmm. I think there's a pretty good argument for it sticking with TSN for a long while.
And does I think it's fair to say likely addition of a 10th team in the next couple of mm-hmm. seasons, at least that seems to be where the momentum is moving at this point. Does that 10th team change that conversation in any way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it does. I think especially if you get it into Atlantic Canada, although it's not a huge market. I mean, we have to keep in mind that there aren't all that many people that live in Atlantic Canada, but that is a market that really currently isn't a big deal for the CFL. There's no local team, and so there are a significant amount of people there you're not counting in. But even beyond that, the bigger thing with a 10th team is just the more games you're adding. You're adding more inventory, and that's going to make the price of the contract go up. And what's going to be really interesting to see there, though, is what everyone thinks about how much it should go up by. The CFL obviously would love for it to go up by enough to keep the per team payments equal or maybe even higher if they're able to get that. But you're going to see the broadcasters argue that no, this isn't actually increasing the value of the CFL by a full tenth or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to argue for giving them a smaller increase and thus less money per team. And I think you're going to have a lot of those discussions before this team actually even comes in. And that's going to determine how determined the CFL is to make this work. If the broadcasters really want that and indicate they're willing to pay more, it's going to boost the amount of money that each franchise gets per TV, then I think you'll see the CFL try harder to make it work, even if the ownership group isn't perfect, even if the stadium group isn't perfect. TV really can be the driver here, and if TV wants that extra inventory, then I think it'll happen. But if TV is more lukewarm on that, and that particularly happens if you don't get that interest from Rogers, if you don't have a sense that anyone else other than Bell is really going to bid, and if Bell makes it clear, well, we don't think you're boosting it by a full 10th here, I think that hurts the expansion momentum quite a bit, and it makes it so the CFL will be more reliant on, does the stadium work? Does the owner work? Are we going to get good gate revenues? Because you can overlook a lot of that if you've got the TV money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And when you're talking about that 10th team too, you obviously got to have a stadium in place. And it's kind of a chicken and an egg question for me is, does an ownership group try to get that stadium, try to get that funding done before they know they're going to get granted a franchise? Mm-hmm. Or do they wait, have these discussions, and then if things look good, do they then pursue to see if they could actually get a stadium put together, which basically means their existence or non-existence at that point?
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of a chicken and the egg thing, but I think that in those sorts of conversations, especially with something like this, with the CFL, compared to a lot of leagues, it's not so much a guaranteed thing of if you build it, they will come. And we see that even in a lot of other leagues. I mean, Kansas City built that giant arena and never got anything to fill it. But I think CFL expansion or relocation is much less of a certainty or even a good bet than it is in any other league. The CFL doesn't have to expand. The CFL could be fine with just 9 teams. And I don't think they're going to expand unless they're really confident in the idea. So I don't think you're going to get anyone building a stadium in the hopes that the CFL will come there. It's not a good enough bet, really. I think what you are going to see is a lot of very sort of off the books talks. You're going to see a lot of conversations between the TV people, between CFL executives, and between the people interested in making this a go. And I think while you won't have any formal assurances that okay, if you build this, you'll get a team necessarily, I think anybody who's going to build something is going to have some pretty strong, at least off the books, assurances that yes, this will lead to something. I don't think you're going to see that happen on speculation.
So if you were a gambling man, if there is an Atlantic team, mm-hmm. what is the, in your mind, the absolute earliest year that it enters the league?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I'm going to say they start play in 2022 if there actually is one. I don't think we're particularly close to a team or to an announcement at this point. I think that if we do get one, it's going to be something like we saw with Ottawa, where there's a couple of years of run-up between the announcement and when they actually start play. And 2022 makes sense because of the TV angle, because that's going to be the first year of whatever TV contract follows this one. So it would make sense that that's coming in with a different rate, whether that's higher or lower per team. And I think that's doable. I mean, I think in order for that to happen, we'd have to see a lot of progress pretty quickly. I think we would have to see a stadium at least announced probably by next year, by 2019, and construction probably start partway through the year in 2020, because we all know it takes quite a while to build those things. Mm-hmm. I think you'd have to see an ownership group really firm up and materialize over this year and into next year, and then you'll have to see the plan in place from the league standpoint on how many drafts are they going to participate in, how's that going to work, and so on. So there isn't a lot of time for it to happen by 2022, and I think it's possible it could be even later, but that's about the earliest I can see it.
And if you're a fan, you know, you're sitting there thinking, come on, it can be sooner, but you know, those are the realities that you need 4 or 5 critical pegs in place. Mm-hmm. And one of the pegs is obviously enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. But with all due respect to enthusiasm, that might be the weakest of the pegs in terms of stadium, in terms of ownership, in mm-hmm. terms of the financial structure, you know, the player contracts, et cetera, so and so down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think this is something where I think taking it slowly and getting it right makes a lot of sense. We saw that with Ottawa. We saw that the CFL made sure they had a very good ownership group lined up with deep pockets. They had a good stadium solution lined up. It wasn't like the previous attempts in Ottawa, specifically the Renegades, that came in sort of half-baked, never really made much of an impression, and then folded a few years later. And as we saw with the CFL USA era in particular, there's a whole lot of things that can go wrong if you rush into expansion, if you don't have the right group, if you don't have the right stadium, and if you don't have a real indication that there will be a strong, committed fan base. So I think, like I said earlier, I mean, the CFL doesn't have to have a 10th team. There's a lot of things that would be very good about having a 10th team, but I think the league is better off having 9 teams that are strong versus a 10th team that's not, a 10th team that's going to perennially be in trouble. And so I think they're going to be very careful and very deliberate about this, and we'll see how it goes.
Joe, what do you think?
Yep. I guess the only other question I have then on the 10th team, and then I guess we'll let you go after this. I appreciate the time you're giving us here. But if there is a 10th team at some point in the next 5-10 years, obviously they would be plopped into the East based off of A, their location, and B, where it makes sense to put them in the league format. But does that open up talks about changing the league format any, or do you think the league is committed to the West and East?
Yeah, I mean, we see those discussions all the time of a single table, no divisions, and so on. I think the push for that is actually going to be stronger if the league continues with 9 teams versus if it adds a 10th team. Because the real disparity at the moment is having 5 teams in one division and 4 teams in the other one. And so I think the argument for the single table gets stronger if there's no expansion. If you do get a 10th team, I think that's yet another reason to stay with the 2-division format that has worked well, a format that does have a lot of history behind it. It allows for a bunch for extra rivalry games and so on. So and it also helps minimize the travel a bit. So I think there are lots of reasons to like the current setup, and I think that gets even stronger if you have 2 balanced divisions.
Yep, and I guess the one other follow-up question I have on that then, if you do have that, if you do have the 5 teams on each side and they play everybody home and home, Both divisions will actually play more games against the opposite division than they would inside the division. Do you think it would make any sense at all to unbalance that somewhat? Play, say, 12 games in your division and 6 games against the other? That wipes out something that's really nice about the CFL in that you see every team at home every year and you go to see every team, but do you think that might spice up the division rivalries any?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point and an excellent idea, actually. I think that if they do have the 10 teams, they'd be better off having an unbalanced schedule. Because if you have the balanced schedule, you're right. I mean, that's essentially an argument for a single table in its own right. Most sports where they do have divisions, you play the teams in your division more often, and that's for a number of good reasons. It's for rivalries, which helps sell tickets and help boost attendance, and it's for ease of travel and for playing games against nearby teams. So I think there's a very strong argument for unbalancing the schedule if they do go to 10 teams and having more of those in-division rivalry games. And I don't think too many people are going to be heartbroken if they don't see a team from the other division in their stadium every year. I mean, I think a lot of fans would rather see more games against their most hated rivals.
You know, and
all right, well, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and there's, you know, for especially in the States, you know, we see that with the Power 5 college football divisions where, you know, you'll play everybody within your division every year and you'll play 2, 3, 4, depending upon what the number is. And then you sort of do a home and home series, you know, each year. Yep. So there's certainly a model here in the States to consider.
Well, and I think that's an excellent point. And the way that the Power Five college conferences do it is actually really interesting and maybe poses some ideas for the CFL in doing this. In that they don't, for one thing, they don't have it perfectly balanced. In a lot of those conferences, there are teams from those other divisions that you don't play every year, or you don't even play every couple of years necessarily. And I think the CFL would have an advantage by still having you play every team every year, just not necessarily a home and home. I think that's much the peril you get with the way those Power Five conferences do it sometimes is that certain schools have much easier schedules in certain years than other teams in their division or in their conference just because of who they're not playing. So I'd like to see the CFL avoid that, and I think that's certainly possible given the 18 game schedule and the way that you could play everybody at least once. But the other thing that's interesting and where the CFL can maybe learn in a positive way from that setup is how that setup so that those teams can have rivalry games against teams from the other division. So that if there is a team from the other division that it makes sense for you to play more often, you can find a way to do that. Now, I don't know that you necessarily need that in the CFL because most of the great rivalries are within the division, but those are worth keeping in mind in terms of just because you have divisions doesn't mean you always have to schedule it perfectly balanced. You can work it around to try and get the more marketable matchups.
Sure. Where, you know, for example, you do Winnipeg and Saskatchewan home and home every year, sacrificing, for lack of a better phrase, a home and home with, you know, one of the Eastern teams for Saskatchewan or one of the Western teams. You know, and certainly that you know, again, you go back to television, especially, again, you're looking at a 10th team, that idea of those sort of marquee matchups become more important.
Yeah, well, and we know that they're important in the CFL. If you look at the ratings over the years, the things that always draw really well are especially Labor Day games, where you have the Battle of Ontario with Toronto and Hamilton, where you have a Battle of Alberta with Edmonton and Calgary, the Labor Day Classic and the Banjo Bowl between the Rough Riders and Blue Bombers. Those are games that do better for the CFL than your average regular season game. And so I think they know that those rivalries sell, and I think they're going to do everything in their power to keep them and to promote them.
So I guess the only question, Joe, is it June yet?
Looking out my window, I'm going to say it's no. All right, well, that was Andrew Buchholz. Andrew, before you go, you want to tell the people where they can find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a staff writer for Awful Announcing, covering sports media there. I also work for our associated sports site, The Comeback, and I try and get CFL posts in there every chance I get. And you can find me on Twitter at Andrew Buchholz.
All right, and we'll be back after this on the Rouge, White, and Blue.
You are listening to Rouge, White, and Blue, a proud member of the Canadian Football Podcast Network.
And we are back with the Rouge, White, and Blue. Dr. Rouge and myself are here. Again, Oz Davis is on assignment this week, unfortunately. But, yeah, so that was a great conversation we had with Andrew.
You know, the thing that struck me was that, you know, I remember Randy Ambrosi saying at the fans event at the Grey Cup this year that, you know, the CFL playing season ends – you know, the moment that the Grey Cup game, that the clock gets to zero in the fourth quarter. He said, you know, he said basically the next morning, the business year of the CFL begins. You know, and certainly Ambrosi, with his background in finance, you know, he's going to make those decisions that popular sometimes, unpopular at other times, I think. but that clearly I think he's going to be sort of very data-driven, very finance-driven, very logic-driven in terms of what he does. And I think we're seeing part of that in terms of, you know, if Andrew's right and it's 2022 for a 10th team, you could imagine the fans clamoring, why that long? Why that long? Why? Well, you know what? You want to do it right. Because if you do it right, you don't have to go back and assess the damage, so to speak.
Right. Or yeah, have that was to a great undo it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I've only got one other thing myself this week. I mean, we've talked about some of the player moves. So there are going to be a lot more coming up as free agency starts next week here. But in between the last show and this show, my wife did something wonderful for me. Got in touch with my best friend up in Winnipeg and booked me some tickets for the Banjo Bowl. So I have a Banjo Bowl and Grey Cup in my plans this year. Do you have any regular season games in your plans this year, or is it just Grey Cup for you?
Chances are some combination of the Moretti's will run up to either Hamilton or Toronto, which is a very easy drive from where we are in Pittsburgh. I'm concerned that the distance and the cost, primarily of a flight, might derail my Grey Cup plans, so I may not be in Edmonton in November. But if I'm not there in body, I certainly would be there in spirit.
Well, we'll definitely miss you if you're not there. Of course, I haven't confirmed those plans because the last year this time I thought I was going to.
Yes.
But you know.
But you had a very, shall we say, bundle of good reason not to go.
I sure did, and I just want to verify that there will not be another bundle of good reason before I book those tickets. So that'll probably be April-ish, based off of the math I'm doing.
Getting to TMI territory here, all right?
Well, you just never know.
You just never know. And your little guy will be 3 months next week. Not bad, huh?
3 months next week as of Valentine's Day. So, I mean, if that isn't a sign of something, I don't know what
is. So perhaps a Darius Bowman will sign with the Bombers next Wednesday, and that will be sort of a Valentine's gift, no?
Well, I don't think my wife will appreciate that as much as I would, so I'll have to come up with something else.
Well, as we like to say, you married well, she married well, but then again, they say that about me too, right?
Yep. I mean, as long as they still love us, we did well.
We did indeed. Free agency next week, the draft a couple weeks down the line. And then we really start tapping our fingers going, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, you know?
Well, the CFL is going to give me a wonderful birthday gift this year, and they're going to start preseason games about a week after my birthday. So yeah. I don't think I could ask for a better gift except for, you know, all expenses paid trip somewhere. But, you know, that's getting greedy at that point.
And who knows, at this time next year, we could be only weeks instead of months away from the opening of training camps. And, you know, if the league opts to move the schedule up to, I think most likely, a late March, early April regular season start, you know, maybe a little later than that because of the weather, maybe mid-April is a little more likely, roughly the start of the baseball season. But who knows? It could be a completely different landscape 12 months from now.
I don't know if they'll move it up that far. I mean, they got to worry about the threat from the XFL. I'm sorry. I couldn't finish that with a straight face.
No, that is true. That is true. Yeah, that other league where, you know, a certain quarterback who thought he was going to walk into Hamilton and get oodles upon oodles of money was tweeting that was a league he could get behind. Did he realize that would mean 2 more years of not playing football?
I don't think that was on his mind at that point. Nope, that's for sure.
Hamilton has done the right thing in telling Johnny Manziel to not join the team, so to speak. That was a wise decision.
Yeah, we'll see how wise that stays as the offseason goes by, but we better wrap this up before we take up the whole offseason of the show. I am, once again, Joe Pritchard. You can find me at USFL Tecmo on Twitter. You can find the podcast at RWB Podcast on Twitter. You can also find the show on iTunes, Google Play, and TuneIn Radio.
Indeed, and when I'm not going by Dr. Rouge, it's Anthony Moretti. You can find me on Twitter at Moretti, M-O-R-E-T-T-I-P-H-D. And I often blog about the CFL on my blog, among other things. And when I do, I definitely tweet those links to my Twitter page.
All right. So for myself and Dr. Rouge and for the absent Oz Davis, signing off for this week, this has been the Rouge, White, and Blue podcast.
Thanks for listening. Find more great shows like this at CF Pod Networks on Twitter.